ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Dougal Jelly has turned his hand to quite a few different things in his life so far. Dougal has been a features writer for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. He's been a dishwasher in a cafe, a roustabout in Cooma, and now he's more or less a man about the community. These days, Dougal builds luxurious chicken houses with kids who need a break from the classroom and who want to learn how to make real things with their own hands. Growing up, Dougal had several men in his life who were like extra dads. These were kind men who showed him how stuff works and how to make things. They showed him the pleasures of boat building and fishing and the great outdoors. This has left Dougal with a perpetual hunger to find out how to do new things and pick up new skills. These men opened up the world for Dougal, and now, with sons of his own, he's able to act as an extra dad to their friends. Hello, Dougal.
Oh, Richard, that's lovely. That's a lovely synopsis of a life so far.
You can leave now. That's fine.
Okay. I got stuff to do this afternoon, so yeah.
What have you done already today?
Oh, well, this morning I got up and loaded some plywood boxes that I've spent the last 2 days making. The plywood's, all the timber's recycled material, and I've painted the sides with a logo that a lovely friend down in Hobart helped me design. Recycling for refugees. That's my latest initiative at the moment. I presented to the school community at a whole of school assembly, and all the parents were there. I took along a whole lot of samples of the items that can be recycled and handed them out to the children to drop in these boxes that I've, you know, freshly created. And all the children were screaming and putting, and I felt like a rock star. I felt like this middle-aged rock star. So that was a bit tragic, but no, it was a great experience.
So you said recycling for refugees. How does one connect with the other?
Oh, through a container deposit scheme. So the idea is I'm setting up these collection points in mostly schools and kindergartens, the St Kilda Bowling Club. They've also got one. And I challenged the children this morning to try and raise $500, and I told them how to do it. Come in with a bag and then drop them in these boxes that I've made. I'll get you to help sort them out and we'll count them. There are all sorts of mathematical questioning going on here, but it's also questions about consumption and human behaviour. But it's also about gathering and collecting. And I found that the children are terrific at this. So I'm gathering all of these items and then storing them at various places, including a lovely neighbour, then driving down to Frankston and processing them. And then that money goes into our group, and that money will help welcome and house an Afghan refugee family for the first 12 months of their time in Australia. We'll pick them up at the airport. We'll find short-term accommodation for them. We're thinking about Dandenong because there's a refugee community there already. We'll find long-term accommodation for them. We'll introduce them to schools. We've offered to take in a family. One of the people in the group is a very well-known child psychiatrist who knows about trauma. The others in the group are incredibly capable people, and then there's me. But as I did say to them, you know, what I have that they don't have is a ute.
Yeah, and you're also a bit of a ringmaster too of these sorts of events. Tell me about the recent bout of performative recycling you did near where you live, Dougal.
Yeah, well, and how that came about was on a Saturday afternoon, I took my boys down to St Kilda Beach for dinner, and we came across an Irish St Patrick's Day festival. It was the Saturday. And I said to, you know, a security guard, look, I'm trying to collect waste for refugees. Is there any chance that I could get some of yours? I came back on the Saturday night and just grabbed a whole lot of their bags from bins, big sort of wheelie bins.
Like how many bags were you talking about?
I think I probably took about 6 or 7 bags.
Right.
And it was sort of a mixed waste because it was a family day, so there was a lot of food in there, but also, yeah, a lot of cans and plastic bottles. And early on Sunday morning I took it to a little patch of grass and I spread it all out and I sorted it myself. And I realised then, it took me about an hour, I realised then that from, let's say there were, say, 7 bags, I could condense it down really into about 1 bag of waste. And this is where I was going to funnel the money to. So I drove straight back down to the festival. It's about midday at this stage. And they were just starting up for their Sunday, which was St Patrick's Day. Spoke to the manager and she said, look, that's great. Come back at 10 o'clock tonight. Everyone's going to be drinking, so right. There'll be a lot of cans there for you.
And more rubbish than you can dream of, right?
Well, there was. I was contacting friends at 10:30 on a Sunday night, texting them. I needed space to store waste, basically. And no one picked up their phone. And I got texts like, are you okay? You know, is everything all right? It's like, yes, I just have a waste emergency. I need to get this waste immediately. It was going, you know, either that evening or the first thing in the morning. I did two loads, stacked all these bags up the side of my apartment block. It was like one of those sort of photographs you see of you know, these sort of trucks in, you know, the Indian subcontinent, you know, piled high. I remember on Monday morning, and it was sunny, and all my neighbours were taking photographs of my ute with all of this waste, and it was steaming, and it was all smelling of yeast. But during the week, I took some to a public park and sorted it out, and then I thought, okay, people stopped. It started conversations.
Right, so they're watching you sort all this rubbish out on the lawn of park.
Of a public park.
And they're stopping to watch you do this. Yeah, what do you say when they stop to watch?
Oh, I tell them what I'm doing and I tell them why I'm doing it. So the first time I got the idea of, you know, this circle, and then the second time I went to a more public park and I realised that I should have had gloves there because people were stopping to watch and offer to help out. And then on the Sunday, I decided, well, I'm going to go to a very public park and I'm going to make this a very public performance. And I made signs. And then I just invited passers-by. And for 2 hours, we sorted over 4,000 items and had all of these conversations and created this wonderful sense of community and engagement and a happiness.
So you put on this kind of show where you started to recycle, and then you got how many people ended up being involved in this recycling sorting thing with all these this huge amount of rubbish?
Yeah, I call it a sorting circle, and it actually reminds me a little bit of an Aboriginal midden in a way. What I found doing it by myself is I gained pleasure out of creating a sense of order from the waste. I gained a sort of a satisfaction in the process and of sort of making things neat, and I collected all those cans together, and that made me happy doing that. So I had the children do that as well. I also found that opened up these conversations. We're all doing this on our knees, very grounded, and we were sort of shoulder to shoulder. We didn't have to look at people directly. So it opened up these wonderful conversations about recycling, about consumption, about volumes, about, you know, multiplications, about communities, about human behaviour. Maybe 20 people joined. It was actually the Sunday when the Australian Grand Prix was on, so everybody was consumed by that. And meanwhile, while their backs are turned, we're in this park making our own fun.
So where did you grow up, Dugald?
Well, I was born in Melbourne. I am a Melburnian, but the most formative part of my life was growing up in a farmhouse behind a levee bank in a bean field by the banks of the Snowy River in a very sort of isolated community upstream of Orbost in far east Gippsland. I was taken there when I was 4 years old. My father was an engineer, and he was in charge of a bridge construction over the Snowy River. My mother was an art teacher at the local high school. And for a four-year-old, I often think back to this, of this precious time in our lives of when the world is awakening to us, and that was a magical experience. And to be on the edge of a forest by a river, going out the backyard and picking beans for dinner every night. You know, I can always remember taking the stainless steel colander out there, and I can remember, you know, the trees that fell over, the levee bank that I rode my bicycle down, my tricycle back then, the flowing water, the valley. This was a pivotal time in my life, and it's really stuck with me. I had two older sisters then. I've a younger brother who didn't have that experience, and it has shaped who I am.
You said your mother was an art teacher. Did she involve you in her art classes?
No, but she used to give me paper. I've all my childhood drawings are on this paper that has these wonderful engineering diagrams on it from bridge construction, you know, the reverse side of it. I love drawing. That was my escapism. I still love art.
How was your father with you?
Oh, my father was a good father. You know, he's a very decent man. He's a very honourable man, a very fair man, very community-minded. He was a bridge builder, a civil engineer, and I've thought often about, you know, bridge builders are about connecting people, and my father's always done that. I was sort of, you know, I had a pretty blessed childhood.
What kind of things did you used to do with your dad?
Well, not as much as I did with other parents, actually. And that's partly that's because I was one of four, and my elder sister was born with brain damage. So she had special needs. You know, I have fond memories of, of going to the football with my father. Did with other dads, though. But, you know, Dad's now, the president of the Retirees Association. He's just, consumed in that world. So parts of my father that I picked up is that community-orientated. You know, when I played hockey as a junior. He was the president of the hockey club. The primary school that I went to when I moved to Melbourne in grade two, he was the president of the parents. And, he was involved. I love team sport, always have, still play it. And every game I played as a junior, my father was always there on the sidelines, 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, back when we used to have frosts.
You mentioned that you had a disabled older sister. When you have a sister who's profoundly disabled like that, what does that teach you about the world that perhaps other people and other kids don't get to find out?
Empathy. Yeah, absolute empathy. Thinking of others that are less able, that don't have the opportunities. I have a range of emotions and talking about it now, I feel a sort of a pang of sadness, actually. Sa's a beautiful, beautiful woman, has a very small life, has a very, doesn't have friends, needs assistance, but incredibly loyal. Her and I have a special relationship. She's a mad North Melbourne supporter, goes along to all the games by herself, and often texts me before the games. And her team are the bottom of the ladder at the moment. Mine is second last. So we've got a sort of a fraternity there.
What does it do to the family dynamic?
I can't speak for all families, but for my family, we are very close. Yeah, we know that when my parents die, that us siblings will need to look after Sa. And she knows, and my parents know, that we have the capacity to solve this problem as well.
Like most Victorians, you're footy mad. In fact, your bio says Dougal Jelly was born in the third quarter of a Richmond victory over Hawthorn at the MCG. It's that specific indeed. So tell me about the grand final match your father took you to.
I took him. I used to do a morning paper round, and on a Saturday morning before the grand final, Essendon and his team were playing Hawthorn. I think it was 1984. I would have been 14 years old. And somebody came to the news agency and had a spare ticket. And I rang up Dad, who was still at home in bed, and said, look, I can buy a ticket. And, do you want me to buy it? Well, it was actually two tickets. So I paid the guy out of my, my princely sum. And turns out they were standing room tickets. We didn't sort of realise. No, we did realise this because we took a couple of camping chairs along. I mean, my dad is project manages these big bridges, but these sort of simple things, he sometimes has trouble sort of grappling with them. So we went to the MCG.
With camping chairs.
With camping chairs on grand final day in standing room up the Punt Road end. And was told, we couldn't take them in, so we put them in storage. And of course, when we got there, the standing room was just chock-a-block. But Dad being Dad, just sort of shuffled his big man. He used to play ruck for Colac Football Club. He sort of edged his way to the middle of the crowd, and we found a spot. All these sort of disapproving looks, but once the game started, it didn't really matter. It was one of the most memorable afternoons of my childhood. Essendon had a very famous come-from-behind win in the last quarter. My dad was so happy, and I think, deep psychologically, I sort of, children always want to, they seek the approval of their parents, but they also want to make their parents happy.
And you'd made him happy
that day. I'd made him happy, and I'll never forget that afternoon. And all the people around us in the crowd as well. It was, it's like the theatre of football.
You mentioned there were other dads around who were wonderful to you at that point in your life, during your boyhood. Who are you thinking about primarily there?
I think two in particular. One was the father of best mate, JJ. His name is Bruce Jacobs. Bruce was a keen fisherman. He was good with his hands. Unlike my father, he had the most amazing shed garage. I think he had two or three sheds. And Bruce used to run a carpet factory out in Footscray. And I remember when one of my first paychecks was doing a week of work at the carpet factory, doing some sort of manual labour. But Bruce had two daughters, and their youngest child was a son, JJ, who was a great mate of mine. He lived nearby, and I used to ride my bike there, and there'd always be, old Buicks and boats, and they had pigeons in the backyard, they had ducks. It was sort of this magical life. He was a pigeon fancier. But one of a fond story I have with Bruce was he bought an old timber runabout boat. secondhand somewhere. And Justin and myself scraped back. After school, we go around there, and he had these sort of tools. We scraped back all the paint, and he recorked it and sealed it. He bought a little outboard motor, and we took that boat out into the ocean fishing. Got swamped by waves on our first launch at off Point Road night. He took me camping, he took me fishing, and late in his life, I mean, my father said that, you know, Bruce is unwell, and I wrote him a letter just letting him know of the kindness that he'd shown toward me, and how I could still smell his garage. You know, I was still in wonder of all the tools that he had on his benches. I was still thankful of fishing trips, you know, to lakes and to rivers and to piers, going away for the weekend with him and his son. He'd shaped, you know, who I am, and also what a parent could be. You know, my father didn't have the ability to do that. We went on wonderful camping holidays as a whole family, but my father wasn't interested in fishing. Bruce was, or Jake, as we all called him. I had a great privilege, actually, of talking at his memorial service, and I was one of his daughters actually had the letter. And I said to Bruce, you don't have to reply to this letter. This is just how I think of you.
And what did you write in the letter?
My gratitude. Yeah, just my gratitude for having him in my life.
Do you remember what you said?
Oh, I said how it's sort of no coincidence how, you know, I now really like working with tools, making things, and about how, you know, he had influenced that part of my life. I thanked him for taking me away, for showing things that otherwise I wouldn't have seen. And other fathers, you know, took me on road. Lindsay Sparrow's another one, took me skiing when I was younger. I remember, you know, the chains of his old Persia falling off on the road up to Mount Hotham, and me running out and running back through a blizzard, you know, to pick up the chains, icy cold. But, you know, my father couldn't take me skiing, but Lindsay did. And likewise on, he drove me from Melbourne up to Gosford once on the central coast of New South Wales. And those cuttings through that sandstone north of Sydney, you know, just had this profound effect on me. I'll always remember the colour of that rock and the sort of the engineering of these roads cut through these mountains. And he showed me that.
You moved to Sydney once you hit your 20s, Dougald, and became a journalist. What kind of journalistic work were you doing?
I was working. I started off at the Age newspaper in night shift police rounds. They didn't give me a cadetship. They thought I was an unsure bet. Probably was.
You're kind of literally blooded when you do night shift police rounds as a journo, don't you?
Well, it was baptism of fire, as they might say, or murder, or, you know, road accidents, or it was. I was working from 7 o'clock till 3 o'clock in the morning. I was in my early 20s. I was listening to the Police Scanner, fearing the next, you know, Huddle Street or Queen Street massacre. There was a serial killer in Melbourne at the time down in Frankston. And I would go to scenes and I would write in a notepad a story of something that happened. You know, it might have been a B-double truck tipping and catching on fire and blocking a freeway and, you know, two people killed or and I'd write this story on a notepad, and I'd ring up the newspaper. There was an early mobile phone, like a brick in the middle of the car, and I'd dictate it out to a typist. And then within about an hour, when I'd go and pick up the first edition papers, the Herald Sun and the Age, and on the second edition there would be the story that I wrote. So it was quite exhilarating when something happened, but also long patches of boredom. So, yeah, I started at the Age and then moved up to Sydney in my late 20s and look, got a plum job as a features writer in the Sydney Morning Herald.
And then you left. Why did you want to leave that job?
I worked there for 18 months and I love newspapers and I love storytelling, but I realised that the stories that I was writing were for a very particular part of Sydney. I was writing for essentially the eastern suburbs, lower north shore and inner west. And to me, I used to call us battery journalists. You know, we go out, with our notepads and tape recorders and interview people and go back and just, you know, sit there and peck away and, you know, wonderful, interesting people around me. But I just thought in my late 20s that life is richer than this and life is more precious than this.
So where did you go when you left that job?
I went and worked for a builder or a couple of builders. I've always been keen in architecture. I'm a failed architecture student, but the love of design has never left me. And I wrote letters to two of the best architects, ones that I admire. One was Glenn Merkert, the other one was Richard LaPlastria, and asked to get in contact with their builders. So I started off working in houses in Paddington and Rushcutters Bay, Glenn Merkert's houses. And then I met this amazing man who was doing a job up in the Blue Mountains, and he gave me a call. Jeffrey Broadfield's his name. He's a master builder and a beautiful man and a mentor of mine. And he took me on. I said, look, I'm a writer. I know nothing about tools. I basically want to learn how to use tools. And he had a workshop up in Mona Vale, up in the Northern Beaches. And I was living in Darling Point at the time. Sounds fancy, but it was the most rundown old apartment block. It was sort of almost like half underground. It's like a gardener's cottage, really. And I used to drive up through the Wakehurst Parkway through those beautiful Angophoras and went to this workshop, and he would make all of what we would make would be made in a workshop and then taken to site. There was a precision, and I didn't understand that, but I could see why, because what he was making was art. Richard is an amazing architect, and Jeffrey had this workshop that was two architects. One was a naval architect. One was another architect who just basically wanted to work on the tools. There was a bloke who was a sculptor. There was a woman who was an actor. And then there was me, who was a former newspaper writer. And there was an apprentice, a young bloke who's doing an apprenticeship. So we had this, sort of sheltered workshop of all these sort of interesting lost souls. But I loved the camaraderie of it. And I realised early on where, if you work for a newspaper, fascinating places to work at, and I was lucky in that I worked in, you know, probably two of the most dynamic newsrooms in Australia, but you're essentially working for yourself, and there's a lot of competitive tension in getting the best stories and all that sort of stuff. Working with this group of people, I could see collaboration. It was a great sense of community. When Smoko came and all the tools stopped and we all sat down and had morning tea and lunch together, we're all working for the one purpose.
So after that, what did you want to try next after putting your hand to becoming a builder, Dugald?
I wanted to go and write a novel. I remember Jeffrey saying, you know, do you want to do an apprenticeship? And I said, no, I just want to go and try and write a novel. So I decided to leave Darling Point and a lovely relationship I was in at the time. I thought I could continue that, but I packed up all my belongings and had a going away party from Sydney in the old that old unit, and drove south. I crossed the border again and went back to my childhood. I went back to the Snowy River, and I rented an old farmhouse. I didn't realise no one had been living in it. I went down and found it. Thought, that's perfect. The house that I grew up in a child had been demolished, so that was disappointing. But there's one a little further upstream, right on the edge of the forest, and the old Mundy house been flooded, you know, several times, had this sort of wonderlick pressed metal walls and ceiling, and I gather there was no plaster there because when they got flooded, they just sort of hose it out and start again. And so moving from Darling Point to this, you know, condemned house was a deeply sort of humbling experience.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can find more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
Dougald, you were telling us about moving back to the Snowy River region. How did you find work in that area?
Well, mostly through football, and joined a local footy team, played centre-half forward for the Snowy Rovers. My first paycheck actually was through the footy club. In my second game, I kicked three goals against the crosstown rivals, Orbost. And at the bar after the game, they put $50 in my hand. I asked all the local dairy farmers. I worked in milking pits. As with much of my life, I asked and people were incredibly generous, including Don and Bock Nettleton, who I used to, you know, milk with most afternoons. I milked in every milking shed in a place called Beepalong where I lived.
Then you got a job as a roustabout, a shearer's roustabout.
Yeah.
What's the work of an actual roustabout?
So after Orbost, I moved up to Cooma and moved up in the middle of winter. And I joined the local footy team up there, the Cooma Cats. I remember the first training session I went to. It was at Snowy Oval, and all the players were wearing balaclavas, and it's like they're bank robbers. But I realised why, because snow was falling on a Thursday night. It was very cold. But through the football club, I had several jobs, and one of those was through a local farmer. And, yeah, he offered me a job as a roustabout when the shearers came through. So my job was to pick up the fleeces off the floor from the shearers, toss them onto the table and skirt them. You'd walk along the side of the fleece and just pick away the edges of where the sort of the dung was, or where the wool was imperfect, where it was dirty. So you'd skirt the fleece, and then the property owner would sort of grade them on the spot. And you throw them into the bins according to the quality that he thought the wool was.
There's something lovely about those old timber shearing sheds. I've been in a few in my time. There's something really beautiful about those buildings, isn't there?
I just think it's an Australian vernacular architecture, and it's a tin roof and it's timber and the stilts. I love the stilts, and they're all sort of embalmed in lanolin. You know, it's this most beautiful resin. Everything, all the timber is soft and preserved. The smell of them, you know, I'm the sort of person who, if I drive through a dairy area, I'll in South Gippsland, I'll wind the window down and smell the cow shit. And it, to me, it's home. And it's the same with sheep shit. And I'll ask the farmer to bag it up because it's great manure. But for me, there's life there. You know, there's fertility there.
I've been in a few shearers' pubs in my time, and the conversation is always sparkling in a shearers' pub. Did you find that in the local pubs?
They were storytellers. So we'd work, I think from memory, you worked from 7:30 to about 5:30. It's a long day, and for them it's a backbreaking day. But my goodness, and they'd invite me to the pub afterwards, and I felt churlish not going. So I'd go along, and their stories for me were wonderful. And it was stories of a part of Australia that I didn't really know. I was sort of schooled in the forests of East Gippsland. There were stories of the other side of the Great Dividing Range, of a certain place and a climate and a temperament, all through the sort of the Darling River system. And I remember them telling me stories of the chinchilla killer. You know, this bloke from, I've never been to Chinchilla. I believe it's in outback Queensland. But the feats that he could get up to, the number of sheep that he could shear in a day. The chinchilla killer.
Was he an actual killer or just very good at shearing sheep?
Well, as they say, he was a gun. There's a competitive tension among shearers because you're paid per sheep, and he was the standout.
So fast forward a few years and you got partnered up and you got two kids of your own, two boys of your own. How old were you when you became a dad, Dougald?
I was 39 and a half.
Did you think of that as being late or just about right?
At the time, I was the oldest first-time father I knew. So that presents, that's a different type of fatherhood. It's a different type of fatherhood than the father that I had.
How do you think it makes it different?
It's different because you're a little bit older. You've had life experience. You don't have as much energy, you know, physical energy. I see, you know, 20-year-old mums or 20-year-old fathers and they've got energy, but I had a full life behind me. I think of it in years to come, my boys may never have grandchildren. I'm an older dad at school, you know, at all the sort of school events, and I've been very involved in their schools and kindergartens. Oh, look, as the kids say, it is what it is, and you make the best of it. But I do think that, you know, there actually is. I've written a story about this, about becoming an older first-time father. And at the moment, you know, my generation are in a great social experiment, and that is we're delaying fatherhood, as are women, more than most other countries in the world. Australian fathers are, the stats show, among the oldest first-time fathers in the world. Various reasons behind this. My generation, Generation X, if you want to label it, part of this sort of, yeah, it's an experiment. We'll see how it goes.
How did you take to being a father?
I relish it. You know, it's a privilege and an honour. I always wanted to be a father. I loved it. And it was a great privilege, but it also caused me a lot of anxiety. Partly that was where we were living at the time. It's an affluent part of Melbourne where you get a lot of these sort of nuclear families and the dad goes off, you know, to a corporate job. So by me getting involved in a local primary school was actually challenging a lot of people. And it was challenging myself. There's only one other father in the area in that community. If I'd have been growing up in another part of Melbourne or Sydney, that would have been different. But I was very cognizant that what I was doing was unusual. And the way that I embraced it was fully. You know, within the first year, I was wheeling my eldest boy to school on a wheelbarrow down High Street in Armidale with loads of timber and hammers, and I'd deliver him to school on a wheelbarrow.
On your way to work?
On my way to work, yeah. My first job there was to build some planter boxes. I could see a need. You know, before I arrived at that school, they grew no vegetables. I remember growing sweet corn and sunflowers and all of that through the children.
You and your partner split during the COVID era. And what state were you in after that happened, Dougald?
Not a particularly good state. Our separation was amicable, as people say. It was a considered decision from both of us. It was emotionally a difficult time for me, and financially it was a difficult time for me. And I guess I was fortunate that I had a lot of friends that helped me out, helped me furnish a new apartment. It was a time where I just had to get through, and I knew that there'd be better times ahead, but I just had to work my way through it.
So you've been a builder, you've been a journalist, builder, a roustabout. You've done a whole lot of different things. Did you want to go back to that or try something
well,
new?
Well, I did apply for a couple of sort of comms jobs, and I did have a comms job for precisely a year in Sydney. I quit at 12 months because, you know, life's too short for that. And I did apply for some of those jobs and never even got an interview. A friend said there was a job going at a great Melbourne cafe called The Galleon down in St Kilda and as a dishwasher. I actually rode my bike down there and got to outside The Galleon, saw some of the wait staff, and there one young bloke, Callum, an Englishman, has got these funky tattoos and he just, you know, holds himself in a particular way. And I rode back, I can't do it. You know, I'm too old for this. You know, I don't know how to wash dishes, you know. So I remember texting the owner and said, look, you know, this is where I'm at. And she said, just come in and give it a go. And I did, and I really enjoyed it. And I worked there 2 days a week and it helped pay the rent.
You're obviously a people person. How did you manage to sort of reach out from that job, which can be a lonely one actually, being the dishwasher in a cafe?
Well, where the sinks were was just behind the barista in the main area. And I really love the sense of community of the cafe. For me, I often tell people, and I said, you know, why are you doing that? I said, well, I found it very grounding. I found it like my ballast. Every Monday morning and Tuesday, I knew what I was doing. And it was money in the tin to help pay the rent. But then I found that I love the camaraderie of the work in a tight space in hospitality. And when the cafe was busy, when it was humming, you know, my role is as essential as anybody else's. You know, I've just got to get the dishes and the crockery and cutlery cleaned, and there's a sort of a beauty in that system. But I also enjoyed the customers that would walk in, and often I found there are a lot who this was their part of their home, and this was part of their social contact for the day, and I would just gesture with a smile. I'd often just tap people on the elbow when I was passing behind them, and I think that's. I sort of realised that touch and that questioning, and often people who I could see were from elsewhere by the clothes they were wearing, their accent. I'd ask them a question and just be interested in their lives. And a lot of the other stuff sometimes found that a bit annoying, but there was also, it would just lift spirits, you know. I used to pick up babies, you know, baby cry, young baby, I'd offer, take my gloves off, you know, do you just want 5 minutes respite? And as one woman said, I would. And, you know, picked up a newborn and walked it around the cafe and outside on the street while she could have a lunch. And, you know, the privilege was in holding a newborn, but also the privilege was in trust. You know, she didn't know me, but she trusted me with this, you know, precious object. And, you know, I like showing other people in that cafe, you know, how you can help.
Given that you'd really thrive with the attention from the extra dads from your boyhood, tell me how you've been able to do that for other kids, for other boys in particular around you.
Well, not just boys, but, you know, children in...
Other kids around you.
Well, yeah. Other kids, yeah. But I do have a great rapport. I mean, this morning after I finished this presentation at the school, I did a job at that school last year, built a chicken house. I stipulated that if I'm going to build it, I need the children to help me. So we put out a, you know, call for nominations. I think there were sort of 150, 200 people. But I said to them, look, I want the children who have trouble in class, the children who are disruptive, the children who learning is not so easy for them. And I think this comes back to my sister in some ways, my elder sister. I wanted to help those who needed, who just taking them out of the classroom and thinking in other ways might sort of enrich their education, enrich their childhood. And it was a magical project. You know, it really, it's a beautiful chicken house we've built. The school, you know, didn't imagine what we would create, but I knew what we'd create. I knew what I'd do. Total labour of love. I mean, I sort of divide the hours of work and the materials for what they pay me. But, you know, for me, it's not about the money. You know, it's about the joy and the experience and the connection that I make with those children.
Are you making more than just a chicken house here? Are these kind of special chicken houses, Dougal?
I like to think it's an object of beauty. There was actually a Dutchman outside the school today, you know, and he was offering to collect for me. And I said, oh, you know, I made the chicken house. And he said, it's beautiful. I remember one of the mums who was an artist. I wanted to paint several parts of the chicken house. And I said to her, you know, if you want, put a painting on it. And she looked at it and said, no, it's perfect. It's very organic. It's very Glen Merkitt, you know, got this sort of floating roof. It's got my materials are corrugated iron timber. It's got some bluestone steps. I remember one of the mums, they invited me along to their Christmas drinks and she loved the typography of the building and she wanted to replicate that around the school. And I said, yeah, great. But the problem for me is funding. You know, I work outside of an education system. I'm not a teacher. But my next job I'm going to is to build an adventure playground, an adventure balance beam playground with children at another primary school. I've done some work for them in the past, including a stick fence where I organised a bring a stick to school day, which was kind of magical, seeing all these children arriving at 9 o'clock in the morning with this forest of sticks. The next project, I've co-designed this with the children. So I've, you know, I've had some workshops with them. We've talked about materials and I believe in empowering children. And I'm such a believer in letting them create their own spaces. And this all started from when my boys were young and being involved in a local kindergarten and then schools. And seeing outside contractors come in and construct things, and the children had no voice. First thing I tell children is if you want to design like a child, get down to a child's height. When I designed this chicken house for the children, one of the first things I thought, let's think about the chickens. Let's all get down to height of a chicken. Let's see the world from a chicken's perspective. But I also, we need to design this for you and your parents as well. They need to be able to use this sort of building. So it's a sort of just a consideration of functionality, but who you're designing for. And children are my clients.
What kind of things do these kids have in common? Are you looking for a specific kind of kids to reach out to with this work?
I want to open up adventure for children. I want to create fun. I want to give them a solution.
Aren't you looking particularly to help emotionally troubled kids at the moment?
They're the ones I think I enjoy working with the most. I love the way their mind works. I love the conversations. This school where I'm building the Adventure Park playground, I have this sort of rapport with the school now where the children can come out if they're having trouble in class and they come and work with me, I show them how to use a handsaw and teach them about the technique of sawing, the rhythm, to tell them it's a dance. You know, it's not about strength. It's about, you know, technique and finding that sort of that path of the metal teeth cutting through timber. And I asked them to smell the timber. All the timbers I use are recycled, all mostly hardwoods. And then, you know, how to position your body. And there's a great sort of satisfaction in making that cut and of getting through that piece of timber. And I asked them to show the next person how to do it. You know, I'll supervise them, but I trust them.
Oh, that's the key, showing the next kid how to do it. They instruct themselves once you've shown them.
That's it. Yeah, you know, just again, empower them. You know, as I often say, you're all leaders. You decide the rules. You make up the rules. I'll supervise you and I'll sort of, you know, steer you. But, you know, we've made sort of pop-up adventure playgrounds in schools where I've had children, you know, up ladders and making slides and you know, balance beams and seesaws and making them themselves, like just out of found objects.
And what kind of enthusiasm can you unleash in kids when you approach them to help you build things like that?
Oh, unlimited. Yeah, it's children want to help. In my experience, they ask for jobs. They want to help. So my role is to make sure I have jobs for them to do. So at the chicken house, for example, because I'm using hardwoods and, you know, if you bang a nail into these, the kids will never get a nail through and it'll split the timber. So I'd put a pilot hole. You know, I'd have all this timber ready. I'd have all these floorboards ready for them to cut. These are the hammers. This is the drill. These are the nails. This is how you do it. Be careful of your fingers. But even if they bang their fingers, you know, like, you know, we all learn by trial and error. You know, I'm not fussed by that. That's part of the learning process of making mistakes of and they can find their own way. And, you know, when they've achieved something, I see the glances. I see them looking at me for acknowledgement. You know, did you see that? I did that. Showing me, you know, coming up. One boy, I had him with a hacksaw sawing through a screw that I just couldn't get out of an old bit of timber we were using. And it took him, you know, the whole session, maybe 40 minutes. But he came over, this, you know, big smile on his face. I got through that batten head screw, like, round of applause, you know. And I've had kindergarten age. These are sort of, you know, 6 or 7 year old children laying bricks. And I say to them, did you ever think that when you came to school today, you'd think you'd be buttering and laying a brick? Oh, yeah, I did. Of course they didn't. But they, as I say to them, they will pass through that school and they will always know they laid that brick. That was something that they created, they made. And if I can be an avenue, which is, you know, what I enjoy doing, to that, that's an incredibly fulfilling, you know, experience and role that I have in their lives.
You're building hen houses, so let me ask you a chicken and the egg question. you got a lot of buoyancy, Dougal. Do you think it's the buoyancy that carries you through the work, or is it the work that keeps you buoyant?
Oh, a bit of both. I mean, I live a pretty haphazard life in that, you know, I'm living in an old 1932 rental apartment that has a sold sticker on at the moment. There's no great permanency in my life. You know, a couple of friends said, oh, you know, I'm sorry the block's being sold. It's like, well, you know, sometimes it's good to be on your toes. Sometimes it's good to be ready for the next move. And the way I see it is that, you know, if I need to move somewhere, it's an adventure. You know, it's a total adventure. And I'll take my boys with me. I'll find something suitable. But I have no firm footing in the city, which is, you know, for a lot of people that might be troublesome. And it does create its tensions and stresses for me. But I feel as though I feel really blessed. You know, I feel as though I've got so many beautiful people that I've met and who look after me. And in return, and I think this comes really from the work, the community work that I've done of building communities and enriching communities. And it's come back to me. You know, and it's come back to me in so many ways. And sometimes I pinch myself and think, you know, I'm the luckiest man in the world.
Dougal, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you. Congratulations on the work you're doing with kids and with your community as well. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.